The doctor came in. He looked tanned and healthier than ever. He went to the bed and examined the boy. He said,
"His signs are fine. Everything's good."
The mother said, "But he's sleeping."
"Yes,"
the doctor said.
The husband said, "She's tired. She's starved."
The doctor said,
"She should rest. She should eat."
"Anne," the doctor said.
"Thank you," the husband said.
He shook hands with the doctor, and the doctor patted their shoulders and left.
"I suppose one of us should go home and check on things," the man said. "The dog needs to be fed."
"Call the neighbors," the wife said. "Someone will feed him, if you ask them to." She tried to think who. She closed her eyes and tried to think anything at all. After a time, she said, "Maybe I'll do it. Maybe if I'm not here watching, he'll wake up. Maybe it's because I'm watching that he won't."
"That could be it," the husband said.
"I'll go home and take a bath and put on something clean," the woman said.
"I think you should do that," the man said.
She picked up her purse. He helped her into her coat. She moved to the door and looked back. She looked at the child, and then she looked at the father. The husband nodded and smiled. She went past the nurse's station and down to the end of the corridor, where she turned and saw a little waiting room, a family in there, all sitting in wicker chairs, a man in a khaki shirt, a baseball cap pushed back on his head, a large woman wearing a house dress, slippers, a girl in jeans, hair in dozens of kinky braids, the table littered with flimsy wrappers and styrofoam and coffee sticks and packets of salt and pepper.
"Nelson," the woman said. "Is it about Nelson?"
The woman's eyes widened.
"Tell me now, lady," the woman said. "Is it about Nelson?"
The woman was trying to get up from her chair, but the man had his hand closed over her arm.
"Here, here," the man said.
"I'm sorry," the mother said. "I'm looking for the elevator. My son is in the hospital. I can't find the elevator."
"Elevator is down that way," the man said,
and he aimed a finger in the right direction. "My son was hit by a car," the mother said, "but he's going to be all right. He's in shock now, but it might be some kind of coma, too. That's what worries us, the coma part. I'm going out for a little while. Maybe I'll take a bath. But my husband is with him. He's watching. There's a chance everything will change when I'm gone. My name is Anne Weiss." The man shifted in his chair. He shook his head. He said,
"Our Nelson."
She pulled into the driveway. The dog ran out from behind the house. He ran in circles on the grass. She closed her eyes and leaned her head against the wheel. She listened to the ticking of the engine. She got out of the car and went to the door. She turned on lights and put on water for tea. She opened a can and fed the dog. She sat down on the sofa with her tea. The telephone rang. "Yes," she said. "Hello," she said.
"Mrs. Weiss,"
a man's voice said. "Yes," she said. "This is Mrs. Weiss. Is it about Scotty?" she said.
"Scotty," the voice said. "It is about Scotty," the voice said. "It has to do with Scotty, yes."
"Tell the women we're going." Bill Jameson had always been best friends with Jerry Roberts. The two grew up in the South area, near the old fairgrounds, went through grade school and junior high together, and then on to Eisenhower, where they took as many of the same teachers as they could manage, wore each other's shirts and sweaters and pegged pants, and dated and banged the same girls, whichever came up as a matter of course. Summers, they took jobs together, swamping peaches, picking cherries, stringing hops, anything they could do that paid a little and where there was no boss to get on your ass. And then they bought a car together. The summer before their senior year, they chipped in and bought a red 54 Plymouth for $325. They shared it. It worked out fine. But Jerry got married before the end of the first semester and dropped out of school to work steady at Robbie's Mart. As for Bill, he'd dated the girl too. Carol was her name. And she went just fine with Jerry, and Bill went over there every chance he got. It made him feel older, having married friends. He'd go over there for lunch or for supper, and they'd listen to Elvis or to Bill Haley and the Comets. But sometimes Carol and Jerry would start making out right with Bill still there, and he'd have to get up and excuse himself and take a walk to DeZorn's service station to get some coke because there was only the one bed in the apartment, a hideaway that came down in the living room. Or sometimes Jerry and Carol would head off to the bathroom, and Bill would have to move to the kitchen and pretend to be interested in the cupboards and the refrigerator and not trying to listen. So he stopped going over so much. And then June he graduated, took a job at the Derigold plant, and joined the National Guard. In a year he had a milk route of his own and was going steady with Linda. So Bill and Linda would go over to Jerry and Carol's, drink beer, and listen to records. Carol and Linda got along fine, and Bill was flattered when Carol said that, confidentially, Linda was a real person. Jerry liked Linda, too. "She's great," Jerry said. When Bill and Linda got married, Jerry was best man. The reception, of course, was at the Donnelly Hotel, Jerry and Bill cutting up together and linking arms and tossing off glasses of spiked punch. But once, in the middle of all this happiness, Bill looked at Jerry and thought how much older Jerry looked. A lot older than 22. By then, Jerry was the happy father of two kids, and had moved up to assistant manager at Robbie's, and Carol had one in the oven again. They saw each other every Saturday and Sunday, sometimes oftener if it was a holiday. If the weather was good, they'd be over at Jerry's to barbecue hot dogs and turn the kids loose in the wading pool Jerry had got for next to nothing, like a lot of other things he got from the mart. Jerry had a nice house. It was up on a hill overlooking the Natchez. There were other houses around, but not too close. Jerry was doing all right. When Bill and Linda and Jerry and Carol got together, it was always at Jerry's place because Jerry had the barbecue and the records and too many kids to drag around. It was a Sunday at Jerry's place the time it happened. The women were in the kitchen straightening up. Jerry's girls were out in the yard throwing a plastic ball into the wading pool, yelling and splashing after it. Jerry and Bill were sitting in the reclining chairs on the patio, drinking beer and just relaxing. Bill was doing most of the talking. Things about people they knew, about Derigold, about the four-door Pontiac Catalina he was thinking of buying. Jerry was staring at the clothesline, or at the 68 Chevy hardtop that stood in the garage. Bill was thinking how Jerry was getting to be deep, the way he stared all the time and hardly did any talking at all. Bill moved in his chair and lighted a cigarette. He said, "Anything wrong, man? I mean, you know." Jerry finished his beer and then mashed the can. He shrugged. "You know," he said. Bill nodded. Then Jerry said, "How about a little run?"
"Sounds good to me," Bill said.
"I'll tell the women we're going." They took the Natchez River Highway out to Gleed, Jerry driving. The day was sunny and warm, and air blew through the car.
"Where are we headed?" Bill said.
"Let's shoot a few balls."
"Fine with me," Bill said.
He felt a whole lot better just seeing Jerry brighten up.
"Guy's got to get out," Jerry said. He looked at Bill. "You know what I mean?"
Bill understood. He liked to get out with the guys from the plant for the Friday night bowling league. He liked to stop off twice a week after work to have a few beers with Jack Broderick. He knew a guy's got to get out.
"Still standing," Jerry said, as they pulled up onto the gravel in front of the rec center.
They went inside, Bill holding the door for Jerry, Jerry punching Bill lightly in the stomach as he went on by.
"Hey there."
It was Riley.
"Hey, how you boys keeping?"
It was Riley coming around from behind the counter, grinning. He was a heavy man. He had on a short-sleeved Hawaiian shirt that hung outside his jeans. Riley said,
So, how you boys been keeping?
Dry up and give us a couple of ollies, Jerry said, winking at Bill.
So how you been, Riley? Jerry said.
Riley said,
So how you boys doing? Where you been keeping yourselves? You boys getting any on the side?
Jerry, the last time I seen you, your old lady was 6 months gone.
Jerry stood a minute and blinked his eyes.
So how about the ollies? Bill said.
They took stools near the window. Jerry said,
What kind of place is this, Riley, that it don't have any girls on a Sunday afternoon?
Riley laughed. He said,
I guess they're all in church, praying for it.
They each had 5 cans of beer and took 2 hours to play 3 racks of rotation and 2 racks of snooker, Riley sitting on a stool and talking and watching them play, Bill always looking at his watch and then looking at Jerry.
Bill said, So what do you think, Jerry? I mean, what do you think? Bill said.
Jerry drained his can, mashed it, then stood for a time, turning the can in his hand. Back on the highway, Jerry opened it up. Little jumps of 85 and 90. They'd just passed an old pickup loaded with furniture when they saw the two girls.
Look at that, Jerry said, slowing. I could use some of that.
Jerry drove another mile or so and then pulled off the road.
Let's go back, Jerry said. Let's try it.
Jesus, Bill said.
I don't know. I could use some, Jerry said.
Bill said,
Yeah, but I don't know.
For Christ's sake, Jerry said.
Bill glanced at his watch and then looked all around. He said,
You do the talking. I'm rusty.
Jerry hooted as he whipped the car around. He slowed when he came nearly even with the girls. He pulled the Chevy onto the shoulder across from them. The girls kept on going on their bicycles, but they looked at each other and laughed. The one on the inside was dark-haired, tall and willowy. The other was light-haired and smaller. They both wore shirts and halters.
Bitches, Jerry said.
He waited for the cars to pass so he could pull a U.
I'll take the brunette, he said. He said, the little one's yours.
Bill moved his back against the front seat and touched the bridge of his sunglasses.
They're not going to do anything, Bill said.
They're going to be on your side, Jerry said.
He pulled across the road and drove back.
Get ready, Jerry said.
Hi, Bill said as the girls bicycled up. My name's Bill said.
That's nice, the brunette said.
Where are you going? Bill said.
The girls didn't answer. The little one laughed. They kept bicycling and Jerry kept driving.
Oh, come on now. Where are you going? Bill said.
No place,
the little one said.
Where's no place? Bill said.
Wouldn't you like to know?
The little one said.
I told you my name, Bill said. What's yours?
My friend's Jerry, Bill said.
The girls looked at each other and laughed. A car came up from behind. The driver hit his horn.
Cram it, Jerry shouted.
He pulled off a little and let the car go around. Then he pulled back up alongside the girls.
Bill said, We'll give you a lift. We'll take you where you want. That's a promise. You must be tired riding those bicycles. You look tired. Too much exercise isn't good for a person, especially for girls.
The girls laughed.
You see? Bill said. Now tell us your names.
I'm Barbara. She's Sharon,
the little one said.
All right, Jerry said. Now find out where they're going.
Where are you girls going? Bill said. Barb?
She laughed.
No place, she said. Just down the road.
Where down the road?
Do you want me to tell them? She said to the other girl. I don't care,
the other girl said.
It doesn't make any difference, she said. I'm not going to go any place with anybody anyway,
the one named Sharon said.
Where are you going? Bill said. Are you going to Picture Rock?
The girls laughed.
That's where they're going, Jerry said.
He fed the Chevy gas and pulled up off onto the shoulder so that the girls had to come by on his side.
Don't be that way, Jerry said. He said, come on.
He said, we're all introduced. The girls just rode on by.
I won't bite you, Jerry shouted.
The brunette glanced back. It seemed to Jerry she was looking at him in the right kind of way, but with a girl you could never be sure. Jerry gunned it back onto the highway, dirt and pebbles flying from under the tires.
We'll be seeing you, Bill called as they went speeding by.
It's in the bag, Jerry said. You see the look that cunt gave me?
I don't know, Bill said. Maybe we should cut for home.
We got it made, Jerry said.
He pulled off the road under some trees. The highway forked here at Picture Rock, one road going on to Yakima, the other heading for Natchez, Enumclaw, the Chinook Pass, Seattle. 100 yards off the road was a high-sloping black mound of rock, part of a low range of hills, honeycombed with footpaths and small caves. Indian sign painting here and there on the cave walls. The cliffside of the rock faced the highway, and all over it there were things like this. Natchez 67, Gleed Wildcats, Jesus Saves, Beat Yakima, Repent Now. They sat in the car smoking cigarettes. Mosquitoes came in and tried to get at their hands.
Wish we had a beer now, Jerry said. I sure could go for a beer, he said.
Bill said, me too,
and looked at his watch. When the girls came into view, Jerry and Bill got out of the car. They leaned against the fender in front.
Remember, Jerry said, starting away from the car. The dark one's mine. You got the other one.
The girls dropped their bicycles and started up one of the paths. They disappeared around a bend and then reappeared again a little higher up. They were standing there and looking down.
What are you guys following us for?
The brunette called down. Jerry just started up the path. The girls turned away and went off again at a trot. Jerry and Bill kept climbing at a walking pace. Bill was smoking a cigarette, stopping every so often to get a good drag. When the path turned, he looked back and caught a glimpse of the car.
Move it, Jerry said. I'm coming, Bill said.
They kept climbing, but then Bill had to catch his breath. He couldn't see the car now. He couldn't see the highway either. To his left and all the way down, he could see a strip of the Natchez like a strip of aluminum foil.
Jerry said, you go right and I'll go straight. We'll cut the cock teasers off.
Bill nodded. He was too winded to speak. He went higher for a while, and then the path began to drop, turning toward the valley. He looked and saw the girls. He saw them crouched behind an outcrop. Maybe they were smiling. Bill took out a cigarette, but he could not get it lit. Then Jerry showed up. It did not matter after that. Bill had just wanted to fuck, or even to see them naked. On the other hand, it was okay with him if it didn't work out. He never knew what Jerry wanted, but it started and ended with a rock. Jerry used the same rock on both girls, first on the girl called Sharon, and then on the one that was supposed to be Bill's, after the denim. Edith Packer had the tape cassette plugged into her ear, and she was smoking one of his cigarettes. The TV played without any volume as she sat on the sofa with her legs tucked under her and turned the pages of a magazine. James Packer came out of the guest room, which was the room he had fixed up as an office, and Edith Packer took the cord from her ear. She put the cigarette in the ashtray and pointed her foot and wiggled her toes in greeting. He said,
are we going or not?
I'm going, she said.
Edith Packer liked classical music. James Packer did not. He was a retired accountant, but he still did returns for some old clients, and he didn't like to hear music when he did it.
If we're going, let's go.
He looked at the TV and then went to turn it off.
I'm going, she said.
She closed the magazine and got up. She left the room and went to the back. He followed her to make sure the back door was locked and also that the porch light was on. Then he stood waiting and waiting in the living room. It was a 10-minute drive to the community center, which meant they were going to miss the first game. In the place where James always parked, there was an old van with markings on it, so he had to keep going to the end of the block. "Lots of cars tonight," Edith said. He said,
"There wouldn't be so many if we'd been on time."
"There'd still be as many, it's just we wouldn't have seen them." She pinched his sleeve, teasing. He said,
"Edith, if we're going to play bingo, we ought to be here on time."
"Hush," Edith Packer said. He found a parking space and turned into it. He switched off the engine and cut the lights. He said,
"I don't know if I feel lucky tonight. I think I felt lucky when I was doing Howard's taxes, but I don't feel lucky now. It's not lucky if you have to start out walking half a mile just to play."
"You stick to me," Edith Packer said. "You'll feel lucky."
"I don't feel lucky yet," James said. "Lock your door."
There was a cold breeze. He zipped the windbreaker to his neck, and she pulled her coat closed. They could hear the surf breaking on the rocks at the bottom of the cliff behind the building. She said,
"I'll take one of your cigarettes first."
They stopped under the street lamp at the corner. It was a damaged street lamp, and wires had been added to support it. The wires moved in the wind, made shadows on the pavement.
"When are you going to stop?"
he said, lighting his cigarette after he'd lighted hers.
"When you stop," she said.
"I'll stop when you stop, just like it was when you stopped drinking. Like that. Like you." "I can teach you to do needlework," he said.
"One needleworker in the house is enough," she said. He took her arm, and they kept on walking. When they reached the entrance, she dropped her cigarette and stepped on it. They went up the steps and into the foyer. There was a sofa in the room, a wooden table, folding chairs stacked up. On the walls were hung photographs of fishing boats and naval vessels, one showing a boat that had turned over, a man standing on the keel and waving. The Packers passed through the foyer, James taking Edith's arm as they entered the corridor. Some club women sat to the side of the far doorway, signing people in as they entered the assembly hall, where a game was already in progress, the numbers being called by a woman who stood on the stage. The Packers hurried to their regular table, but a young couple occupied the Packers' usual places. The girl wore denims, and so did the long-haired man with her. She had rings and bracelets and earrings that made her shiny in the milky light. Just as the Packers came up, the girl turned to the fellow with her and poked her finger at a number on his card. Then she pinched his arm. The fellow had his hair pulled back and tied behind his head, and something else the Packers saw, a tiny gold loop through his earlobe. James guided Edith to another table, turning to look again before sitting down. First he took off his windbreaker and helped Edith with her coat. And then he stared at the couple who had taken their places. The girl was scanning her cards as the numbers were called, leaning over to check the man's cards too, as if, James thought, the fellow did not have sense enough to look after his own numbers. James picked up the stack of bingo cards that had been set out on the table. He gave half to Edith.
"Pick some winners," he said, "because I'm taking these three on top. It doesn't matter which ones I pick. Edith, I don't feel lucky tonight."
"Don't you pay it any attention," she said. "They're not hurting anybody. They're just young, that's all."
He said,
"This is regular Friday night bingo for the people of this community."
She said, "It's a free country." She handed back the stack of cards. He put them on the other side of the table. Then they served themselves from the bowl of beans. James peeled a dollar bill from the roll of bills he kept for bingo nights. He put the dollar next to his cards. One of the club women, a thin woman with bluish hair and a spot on her neck, the Packers knew her only as Alice, would presently come by with a coffee can. She would collect the coins and bills, making change from the can. It was this woman or another woman who paid off the wins. The woman on the stage called,
I-25,
and someone in the hall yelled, Bingo! Alice made her way between the tables. She took up the winning card and held it in her hand as the woman on the stage read out the winning numbers.
It's a bingo, Alice confirmed. That bingo, ladies and gentlemen, is worth $12, the woman on the stage announced. Congratulations to the winner.
The Packers played another 5 games to no effect. James came close once on one of his cards. But then 5 numbers were called in succession, none of them his, the 5th a number that produced a bingo on somebody else's card.
You almost had it that time, Edith said. I was watching your card.
She was teasing me, James said.
He tilted the card and let the beans slide into his hand. He closed his hand and made a fist. He shook the beans in his fist. Something came to him about a boy who'd thrown some beans out a window. The memory reached to him from a long way off, and it made him feel lonely.
Change cards, maybe, Edith said.
It isn't my night, James said.
He looked over at the young couple again. They were laughing at something the fellow had said. James could see they weren't paying attention to anyone else in the hall. Alice came around collecting money for the next game, and just after the first number had been called, James saw the fellow in the denims put down a bean on a card he hadn't paid for. Another number was called, and James saw the fellow do it again. James was amazed. He could not concentrate on his own cards. He kept looking up to see what the fellow in denim was doing.
James, look at your cards, Edith said. You missed N34. Pay attention.
That fellow over there who has our place is cheating. I can't believe my eyes, James said.
How is he cheating? Edith said.
He's playing a card that he hasn't paid for, James said. Somebody ought to report him.
Not you, dear, Edith said.
She spoke slowly and tried to keep her eyes on her cards. She dropped a bean on a number.
The fellow is cheating, James said.
She extracted a bean from her palm and placed it on a number.
Play your cards, Edith said.
He looked back at his cards, but he knew he might as well write this game off. There was no telling how many numbers he had missed, how far behind he had fallen. He squeezed the beans in his fist. The woman on stage called,
G60.
Someone yelled,
Bingo!
Christ, James Packer said.
A 10-minute break was announced. The game after the break would be a blackout, $1 a card, winner takes all. This week's jackpot, $98. There was whistling and clapping. James looked at the couple. The fellow was touching the ring in his ear and staring up at the ceiling. The girl had her hand on his leg.
I have to go to the bathroom, Edith said. Give me your cigarettes.
James said,
and I'll get us some raisin cookies and coffee.
I'll go to the bathroom, Edith said.
But James Packer did not go to get cookies and coffee. Instead, he went to stand behind the chair of the fellow in denim.
I see what you're doing, James said.
The man turned around.
Pardon me?
He said and stared.
What am I doing?
You know, James said.
The girl held her cookie in mid-bite.
A word to the wise, James said.
He walked back to his table. He was trembling. When Edith came back, she handed him the cigarettes and sat down, not talking, not being her jovial self. James looked at her closely. He said,
Edith, has something happened?
I'm spotting again, she said.
Spotting, he said,
but he knew what she meant.
Spotting, he said again very quietly.
Oh dear,
Edith Packer said, picking up some cards and sorting through them.
I think we should go home, he said.
She kept sorting through the cards.
No, let's stay, she said.
It's just the spotting is all. He touched her hand. We'll stay, she said. It'll be all right.
This is the worst bingo night in history, James Packer said.
They played the blackout game, James watching the man in denim. The fellow was still at it, still playing a card he hadn't paid for. From time to time, James checked how Edith was doing, but there was no way of telling. She held her lips pursed together. It could mean anything. Resolve, worry, pain. Or maybe she just liked having her lips that way for this particular game. He had 3 numbers to go on one card and 5 numbers on another, and no chance at all on a 3rd card, when the girl with the man in denim began shrieking,
"Bingo, bingo, bingo, I have a bingo!"
The fellow clapped and shouted with her,
"She's got a bingo! She's got a bingo, folks, a bingo!"
The fellow in denim kept clapping. It was the woman on the stage herself who went to the girl's table to check her card against the master list. She said,
"This young woman has a bingo, and that's a $98 jackpot. Let's give her a round of applause, people. It's a bingo here, a blackout."
Edith clapped along with the rest, but James kept his hands on the table. The fellow in denim hugged the girl when the woman from the stage handed over the cash.
"They'll use it to buy drugs," James said.
They stayed for the rest of the games. They stayed until the last game was played. It was a game called the Progressive, the jackpot increasing from week to week if no one bingoed before so many numbers were called. James put his money down and played his cards with no hope of winning. He waited for the fellow in denim to call bingo. But no one won, and the jackpot would be carried over to the following week, the prize bigger than ever.
"That's bingo for tonight," the woman on the stage proclaimed. "Thank you all for coming. God bless you and good night."
The Packers filed out of the assembly hall along with the rest, somehow managing to fall in behind the fellow in denim and his girl. They saw the girl pat her pocket. They saw the girl put her arm around the fellow's waist.
"Let those people get ahead of us," James said into Edith's ear. "I can't stand to look at them."
Edith said nothing in reply, but she hung back a little to give the couple time to move ahead. Outside, the wind was up. James thought sure he could hear the surf over the sound of engines starting. He saw the couple stop at the van. Of course. He should have put 2 and 2 together.
"The dumbbell," James Packer said.
Edith went into the bathroom and shut the door. James took off his windbreaker and put it down on the back of the sofa. He turned on the TV and took up his place and waited. After a time, Edith came out of the bathroom. James concentrated his attention on the TV. Edith went to the kitchen and ran water. James heard her turn off the faucet. Edith came to the room and said,
"I guess I'll have to see Dr. Crawford in the morning. I guess there really is something happening down there."
"What lousy luck," James said.
She stood there shaking her head. She covered her eyes and leaned into him when he came to put his arms around her.
"Edith, dearest Edith," James Packer said.
He felt awkward and terrified. He stood with his arms more or less holding his wife. She reached for his face and kissed his lips, and then she said goodnight. He went to the refrigerator. He stood in front of the open door and drank tomato juice while he studied everything inside. Cold air blew out at him. He looked at the little packages in the containers of foodstuffs on the shelves, a chicken covered in plastic wrap, the neat, protected exhibits. He shut the door and spit the last of the juice into the sink. Then he rinsed his mouth and made himself a cup of instant coffee. He carried it into the living room. He sat down in front of the TV and lit a cigarette. He understood that it took only one lunatic and a torch to bring everything to ruin. He smoked and finished the coffee, and then he turned the TV off. He went to the bedroom door and listened for a time. He felt unworthy to be listening,
to be standing. Why not someone else? Why not those people tonight? Why not all those people who sail through life free as birds? Why not them instead of Edith? He moved away from the bedroom door. He thought about going for a walk. But the wind was wild now, and he could hear the branches whining in the birch tree behind the house. He sat in front of the TV again, but he did not turn it on. He smoked and thought of that sauntering, arrogant gait as the two of them moved just ahead. If only they knew. If only someone would tell them, just once. He closed his eyes. He would get up early and fix breakfast. He would go with her to see Crawford. If only they had to sit with him in the waiting room. He'd tell them what to expect. He'd set those floozies straight. He'd tell them what was waiting for you after the denim and the earrings, after touching each other and cheating at games. He got up and went into the guest room and turned on the lamp over the bed. He glanced at his papers and at his account books and at the adding machine on his desk. He found a pair of pajamas in one of the drawers. He turned down the covers on the bed. Then he walked back through the house, snapping off lights and checking doors. For a while, he stood looking out the kitchen window at the tree shaking under the force of the wind. He left the porch light on and went back to the guest room. He pushed aside his knitting basket, took up his basket of embroidery, and then settled himself in the chair. He raised the lid of the basket and got out the metal hoop. There was fresh white linen stretched across it. Holding the tiny needle to the light, James Packer stabbed at the eye with a length of blue silk thread. Then he set to work, stitch after stitch, making believe he was waving like the man on the keel. So much water, so close to home. My husband eats with a good appetite, but I don't think he's really hungry. He chews, arms on the table, and stares at something across the room. He looks at me and looks away. He wipes his mouth on the napkin. He shrugs and goes on eating.
What are you staring at me for?
He says.
What is it?
He says and lays down his fork. Was I staring? I say. And shake my head. The telephone rings.
Don't answer it,
he says. It might be your mother, I say.
Watch and see,
he says. I pick up the receiver and listen. My husband stops eating.
What did I tell you?
He says when I hang up. He starts to eat again. Then throws his napkin on his plate. He says,
God damn it, why can't people mind their own business? Tell me what I did wrong and I'll listen. I wasn't the only man there. We talked it over and we all decided. We couldn't just turn around. We were 5 miles from the car. I won't have you passing judgment, do you hear?
You know, I say.
He says, what do I know, Claire? Tell me what I'm supposed to know. I don't know anything except one thing.
He gives me what he thinks is a meaningful look.
She was dead, he says. And I'm as sorry as anyone else, but she was dead.
That's the point, I say. He raises his hands. He pushes his chair away from the table. He takes out his cigarettes and goes out to the back with a can of beer. I see him sit in the lawn chair and pick up the newspaper again. His name is in there on the first page, along with the names of his friends. I close my eyes and hold on to the sink. Then I rake my arm across the drain board and send the dishes to the floor. He doesn't move. I know he's heard. He lifts his head as if still listening, but he doesn't move otherwise. He doesn't turn around. He and Gordon Johnson and Mel Dorn and Vern Williams, they play poker and bowl and fish. They fish every spring and early summer before visiting relatives can get in the way. They are decent men, family men, men who take care of their jobs. They have sons and daughters who go to school with our son, Dean. Last Friday, these family men left for the Natchez River. They parked the car in the mountains and hiked to where they wanted to fish. They carried their bedrolls, their food, their playing cards, their whiskey. They saw the girl before they set up camp. Mel Dorn found her. No clothes on her at all. She was wedged into some branches that stuck out over the water. He called the others and they came to look. They talked about what to do. One of the men, my steward didn't say which, said they should start back at once. The others stirred the sand with their toes, said they didn't feel inclined that way. They pleaded fatigue, the late hour, the fact that the girl wasn't going anywhere. In the end, they went ahead and set up the camp. They built a fire and drank their whiskey. When the moon came up, they talked about the girl. Someone said they should keep the body from drifting away. They took their flashlights and went back to the river. One of the men, it might have been Stuart, waded in and got her. He took her by the fingers and pulled her into shore. He got some nylon cord and tied it to her wrist and then looped the rest around a tree. The next morning they cooked breakfast, drank coffee and drank whiskey, and then split up to fish. That night they cooked fish, cooked potatoes, drank coffee, drank whiskey, then took their cooking things and eating things back down to the river and washed them where the girl was. They played some cards later on. Maybe they played until they couldn't see them anymore. Vern Williams went to sleep, but the others told stories. Gordon Johnson said the trout they'd caught were hard because of the terrible coldness of the water. The next morning they got up late, drank whiskey, fished a little, took down their tents, rolled their sleeping bags, gathered their stuff, and hiked out. They drove until they got to a telephone. It was Stuart who made the call while the others stood around in the sun and listened. He gave the sheriff their names. They had nothing to hide. They weren't ashamed. They said they'd wait until someone could come for better directions and take down their statements. I was asleep when he got home, but I woke up when I heard him in the kitchen. I found him leaning against the refrigerator with a can of beer. He put his heavy arms around me and rubbed his big hands on my back. In bed, he put his hands on me again and then waited as if thinking of something else. I turned and opened my legs. Afterwards, I think he stayed awake. He was up that morning before I could get out of bed, to see if there was something in the paper, I suppose. The telephone began ringing right after 8. "Go to hell," I heard him shout. The telephone rang right again. "I've nothing to add to what I already said to the sheriff." He slammed the receiver down. "What is going on?" I said. It was then that he told me what I just told you. I sweep up the broken dishes and go outside. He is lying on his back on the grass now, the newspaper and can of beer within reach. "Stuart, could we go for a drive?" I say. He rolls over and looks at me. "We'll pick up some beer," he says. He gets to his feet and touches me on the hip as he goes past. "Give me a minute," he says. We drive through town without speaking. He stops at a roadside market for beer. I notice a great stack of papers just inside the door. On the top step, a fat woman in a print dress holds out a licorice stick to a little girl. Later on, we cross Everson Creek and turn into the picnic grounds. The creek runs under the bridge and into a large pond a few hundred yards away. I can see the men out there. I can see them out there, fishing. So much water, so close to home. I say, "Why did you have to go miles away?"
"Don't rile me," he says.
We sit on a bench in the sun. He opens us cans of beer. He says,
Relax, Claire.
They said they were innocent. They said they were crazy. He says...
Who?
He says...
What are you talking about?
The Maddox brothers. They killed a girl named Arlene Hubley where I grew up. They cut off her head and threw her into the Clee Alum River. It happened when I was a girl.
You're going to get me riled,
he says. I look at the creek. I'm right in it. Eyes open, face down, staring at the moss on the bottom, dead.
I don't know what's wrong with you,
he says on the way home.
You're getting me more riled by the minute.
There is nothing I can say to him. He tries to concentrate on the road, but he keeps looking into the rearview mirror. He knows. Stuart believes he is letting me sleep this morning. But I was awake long before the alarm went off. I was thinking, lying on the far side of the bed away from his hairy legs. He gets Dean off for school, and then he shaves, dresses, and leaves for work. Twice he looks in and clears his throat, but I keep my eyes closed. In the kitchen I find a note from him. It's signed, Love. I sit in the breakfast nook and drink coffee and leave a ring on the note. I look at the newspaper and turn it this way and that on the table. Then I skid it close and read what it says. The body has been identified, claimed. But it took some examining it, some putting things into it, some cutting, some weighing, some measuring, some putting things back again and sewing them in. I sit for a long time holding the newspaper and thinking. Then I call up to get a chair at the hairdresser's. I sit under the dryer with a magazine on my lap and let Marnie do my nails. I'm going to a funeral tomorrow, I say. I'm sorry to hear that, Marnie says. It was a murder, I say. That's the worst kind, Marnie says. We weren't all that close, I say, but you know.
We'll get you fixed up for it, Marnie says.
That night I make my bed on the sofa, and in the morning I get up first. I put on coffee and fix breakfast while he shaves. He appears in the kitchen doorway, towel over his bare shoulder, appraising. Here's coffee, I say. Eggs will be ready in a minute. I wake Dean and the three of us eat. Whenever Stuart looks at me, I ask Dean if he wants more milk, more toast, etc.
I'll call you today,
Stuart says as he opens the door. I say, I don't think I'll be home today.
All right,
he says.
Sure.
I dress carefully. I try on a hat and look at myself in the mirror. I write out a note for Dean. Honey, Mommy has things to do this afternoon, but we'll be back later. You stay in or be in the backyard until one of us comes home. Love, Mommy. I look at the word love and then I underline it. Then I see the word backyard. Is it one word or two? I drive through farm country, through fields of oats and sugar beets, and past apple orchards, cattle grazing in pastures. Then everything changes, more like shacks than farmhouses, and stands of timber instead of orchards. Then mountains, and on the right, far below, I sometimes see the Natchez River. A green pickup comes up behind me and stays behind me for miles. I keep slowing at the wrong times, hoping he will pass. Then I speed up. But this is at the wrong times, too. I grip the wheel until my fingers hurt. On a long, clear stretch, he goes past. But he drives along beside for a bit, a crew-cut man in a blue work shirt. We look each other over. Then he waves, toots his horn, and pulls on up ahead. I slow down and find a place. I pull over and shut off the motor. I can hear the river down below the trees. Then I hear the pickup coming back. I lock the doors and roll up the windows.
You all right?
The man says. He raps on the glass.
You okay?
He leans his arms on the door and brings his face to the window. I stare at him. I can't think what else to do.
Is everything all right in there? How come you're all locked up?
I shake my head.
Roll down your window.
He shakes his head and looks at the highway and then back at me.
Roll it down now.
Please, I say. I have to go.
Open the door,
he says as if he isn't listening.
You're going to choke in there.
He looks at my breasts, my legs. I can tell that's what he's doing.
Hey, sugar, he says. I'm just here to help is all.
The casket is closed and covered with floral sprays. The organ starts up the minute I take a seat. People are coming in and finding chairs. There's a boy in flared pants and a yellow short-sleeved shirt. A door opens and the family comes in a group and moves over to a curtained place off to one side. Chairs creak as everybody gets settled. Directly, a nice blonde man in a nice dark suit stands and asks us to bow our heads. He says a prayer for us, the living, and when he finishes, he says a prayer for the soul of the departed. Along with the others, I go past the casket. Then I move out onto the front steps and into the afternoon light. There's a woman who limps as she goes down the stairs ahead of me. On the sidewalk, she looks around.
Well, they got him,
she says, if that's any consolation. They arrested him this morning. I heard it on the radio before I come. A boy right here in town. We move a few steps down the hot sidewalk. People are starting cars. I put out my hand and hold on to a parking meter. Polished hoods and polished fenders. My head swims. I say, they have friends, these killers. You can't tell. I have known that child since she was a little girl, the woman says. She used to come over and I'd bake cookies for her and let her eat them in front of the TV. Back home, Stuart sits at the table with a drink of whiskey in front of him. For a crazy instant, I think something's happened to Dean.
Where is he?
I say. Where is Dean?
Outside, my husband says.
He drains his glass and stands up. He says,
I think I know what you need.
He reaches an arm around my waist, and with his other hand he begins to unbutton my jacket, and then he goes on to the buttons of my blouse.
First things first, he says.
He says something else, but I don't need to listen. I can't hear a thing with so much water going. That's right, I say, finishing the buttons myself. Before Dean comes. Hurry. The third thing that killed my father off.
I'll tell you what did my father in. The third thing was Dummy, that Dummy died. The first thing was Pearl Harbor. And the second thing was moving to my grandfather's farm near Wenatchee. That's where my father finished out his days, except they were probably finished before that. My father blamed Dummy's death on Dummy's wife. Then he blamed it on the fish. And finally, he blamed himself, because he was the one that showed Dummy the ad in the back of Field and Stream for live black bass shipped anywhere in the U.S. It was after he got the fish that Dummy started acting peculiar. The fish changed Dummy's whole personality. That's what my father said. I never knew Dummy's real name. If anyone did, I never heard it. Dummy it was then, and it's Dummy I remember him by now. He was a little wrinkled man, bald-headed, short but very powerful in the arms and legs. If he grinned, which was seldom, his lips folded back over brown, broken teeth. It gave him a crafty expression. His watery eyes stayed fastened on your mouth when you were talking, and if you weren't, they'd go to someplace queer on your body. I don't think he was really deaf, at least not as deaf as he made out. But he sure couldn't talk. That was for certain. Deaf or no, Dummy'd been on as a common laborer out at the sawmill since the 1920s. This was the Cascade Lumber Company in Yakima, Washington. The years I knew him, Dummy was working as a cleanup man. And all those years, I never saw him with anything different on. Meaning a felt hat, a khaki work shirt, a denim jacket over a pair of coveralls. In his top pockets, he carried rolls of toilet paper, as one of his jobs was to clean and supply the toilets. It kept him busy, seeing as how the men on nights used to walk off after their tours with a roll or two in their lunchboxes. Dummy carried a flashlight, even though he worked days. He also carried wrenches, pliers, screwdrivers, friction tape, all the same things the millwrights carried. Well, it made them kid Dummy, the way he was, always carrying everything. Carl Lowe, Ted Slade, Johnny Waite, they were the worst kidders of the ones that kidded Dummy. But Dummy took it all in stride. I think he'd gotten used to it. My father never kidded Dummy. Not to my knowledge, anyway. Dad was a big, heavy-shouldered man with a crew haircut, double chin, and a belly of real size. Dummy was always staring at that belly. He'd come to the filing room where my father worked, and he'd sit on a stool and watch my dad's belly while he used the big emery wheels on the saws. Dummy had a house as good as anyone's. It was a tar paper covered affair near the river, 5 or 6 miles from town. Half a mile behind the house, at the end of a pasture, there lay a big gravel pit that the state had dug when they were paving the roads around there. 3 good-sized holes had been scooped out, and over the years they'd filled with water. By and by, the 3 ponds came together to make one. It was deep. It had a darkish look to it. Dummy had a wife as well as a house. She was a woman years younger and said to go around with Mexicans. Father said it was busybodies that said that, men like Lowe and Waite and Slade. She was a small, stout woman with glittery little eyes. The first time I saw her, I saw those eyes. It was when I was with Pete Jensen and we were on our bicycles and we stopped at Dummy's to get a glass of water. When she opened the door, I told her I was Del Frazier's son. I said, "He works with," and then I realized, "You know, your husband." We were on our bicycles and thought we could get a drink.
"Wait here," she said.
She came back with a little tin cup of water in each hand. I downed mine in a single gulp. But she didn't offer us more. She watched us without saying anything. When we started to get on our bicycles, she came over to the edge of the porch.
"You little fellas had a car now, I might catch a ride with you."
She grinned. Her teeth looked too big for her mouth. "Let's go," Pete said, and we went. There weren't many places you could fish for bass in our part of the state. There was Rainbow, mostly, a few brook and Dolly Varden and some of the high mountain streams, and Silvers and Blue Lake and Lake Rimrock. That was mostly it, except for the runs of steelhead and salmon in some of the freshwater rivers in late fall. But if you were a fisherman, it was enough to keep you busy. No one fished for bass. A lot of people I knew had never seen a bass except for pictures. But my father had seen plenty of them when he was growing up in Arkansas and Georgia, and he had high hopes to do with Dummy's bass, Dummy being a friend. The day the fish arrived, I'd gone swimming at the city pool. I remember coming home and going out again to get them since Dad was going to give Dummy a hand. 3 tanks parcel post from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We went in Dummy's pickup, Dad and Dummy and me. These tanks turned out to be barrels, really, the 3 of them crated in pine lath. They were standing in the shade out back of the train depot, and it took my dad and Dummy both to lift each crate into the truck. Dummy drove very carefully through town and just as carefully all the way to his house. He went right through his yard without stopping. He went on down to within feet of the pond. By that time, it was nearly dark, so he kept his headlights on and took out a hammer and a tire iron from under the seat, and then the 2 of them lugged the crates up close to the water and started tearing open the first one. The barrel inside was wrapped in burlap, and there were these nickel-sized holes in the lid. They raised it off and Dummy aimed his flashlight in. It looked like a million bass fingerlings were finning inside. It was the strangest sight. All those live things busy in there, like a little ocean that had come on the train.
Dummies scooted the barrel to the edge of the water and poured it out. He took his flashlight and shined it into the pond. But there was nothing to be seen anymore. You could hear the frogs going, but you could hear them going any time it newly got dark.
Let me get the other crates,
my father said, and he reached over as if to take the hammer from Dummy's coveralls, but Dummy pulled back and shook his head. He undid the other two crates himself, leaving dark drops of blood on the lath where he ripped his hand doing it. From that night on, Dummy was different. Dummy wouldn't let anyone come around now anymore. He put up fencing all around the pasture, and then he fenced off the pond with electrical barbed wire. They said it cost him all his savings for that fence. Of course, my father wouldn't have anything to do with Dummy after that. Not since Dummy ran him off. Not from fishing, mind you, because the bass were just babies still, but even from trying to get a look. One evening, 2 years after, when Dad was working late and I took him his food and a jar of iced tea, I found him standing talking with Sid Glover, the millwright. Just as I came in, I heard Dad saying,
"You'd reckon the fool was married to them fish the way he acts."
"From what I hear," Sid said, "he'd do better to put that fence round his house."
My father saw me then, and I saw him signal Sid Glover with his eyes. But a month later, my dad finally made Dummy do it. What he did was, he told Dummy how you had to thin out the weak ones on account of keeping things fit for the rest of them. Dummy stood there pulling at his ear and staring at the floor. Dad said, yeah, he'd be down to do it tomorrow because it had to be done. Dummy never said yes, actually. He just never said no is all. All he did was pull on his ear some more. When Dad got home that day, I was ready and waiting. I had his old bass plugs out and was testing the treble hooks with my finger.
"You set?" he called to me, jumping out of the car. "I'll go to the toilet you put the stuff in. You can drive us out there if you want."
I'd stowed everything in the back seat and was trying out the wheel when he came back out wearing his fishing hat and eating a wedge of cake with both hands. Mother was standing in the door watching. She was a fair-skinned woman, her blonde hair pulled back in a tight bun and fastened down with a rhinestone clip. I wonder if she ever went around back in those happy days, or what she ever really did. I let out the handbrake. Mother watched until I'd shifted gears and then, still unsmiling, she went back inside. It was a fine afternoon. We had all the windows down to let the air in. We crossed the Moxie Bridge and swung west onto Slater Road. Alfalfa fields stood off to either side, and farther on it was cornfields. Dad had his hand out the window. He was letting the wind carry it back. He was restless, I could see. It wasn't long before we pulled up at Dummy's. He came out of the house wearing his hat. His wife was looking out the window.
"You got your frying pan ready?"
Dad hollered out to Dummy, but Dummy just stood there eyeing the car.
"Hey, Dummy,"
Dad yelled.
"Hey, Dummy, where's your pole, Dummy?"
Dummy jerked his head back and forth. He moved his weight from one leg to the other and looked at the ground and then at us. His tongue rested on his lower lip, and he began working his foot into the dirt. I shouldered the creel. I handed Dad his pole and picked up my own.
"We set to go?"
Dad said.
"Hey, Dummy, we set to go?"
Dummy took off his hat, and with the same hand, he wiped his wrist over his head. He turned abruptly, and we followed him across the spongy pasture. Every 20 feet or so, a snipe sprang up from the clumps of grass at the edge of the old furrows. At the end of the pasture, the ground sloped gently and became dry and rocky. Nettle bushes and scrub oaks scattered here and there. We cut to the right, following an old set of car tracks, going through a field of milkweed that came up to our waists, the dry pods at the tops of the stalks rattling angrily as we pushed through. Presently, I saw the sheen of water over Dummy's shoulder, and I heard Dad shout,
"Oh, Lord, look at that!"
But Dummy slowed down and kept bringing his hand up and moving his hat back and forth over his head.
and then he just stopped flat. Dad said, "Well, what do you think, dummy? One place good as another? Where do you say we should come onto it?"
Dummy wet his lower lip.
"What's the matter with you, dummy?" Dad said. "It's your pond, ain't it?"
Dummy looked down and picked an ant off his coveralls.
"Well, hell," Dad said, letting out his breath.
He took out his watch.
"If it's still all right with you, we'll get to it before it gets too dark."
Dummy stuck his hands in his pockets and turned back to the pond. He started walking again. We trailed along behind. We could see the whole pond now. The water dimpled with rising fish. Every so often a bass would leap clear and come down in a splash.
"Great God," I heard my father say.
We came up to the pond at an open place, a gravel beach kind of. Dad motioned to me and dropped into a crouch. I dropped too. He was peering into the water in front of us, and when I looked, I saw what had taken him so.
"Honest to God," he whispered.
A school of bass was cruising, 20, 30, not one of them under 2 pounds. They veered off, and then they shifted and came back, so densely spaced they looked like they were bumping up against each other. I could see their big, heavy-lidded eyes watching us as they went by. They flashed away again, and again they came back. They were asking for it. It didn't make any difference if we stayed squatted or stood up. The fish just didn't think a thing about us. I tell you, it was a sight to behold. We sat there for quite a while, watching that school of bass go so innocently about their business, Dummy the whole time pulling at his fingers and looking around as if he expected someone to show up. All over the pond, the bass were coming up to nuzzle the water, or jumping clear and falling back, or coming up to the surface to swim along with their dorsals sticking out. Dad signaled and we got up to cast. I tell you, I was shaky with excitement. I could hardly get the plug loose from the cork handle of my pole. It was while I was trying to get the hooks out that I felt Dummy seize my shoulder with his big fingers. I looked, and in answer, Dummy worked his chin in Dad's direction. What he wanted was clear enough. No more than one pole. Dad took off his hat, and then put it back on, and then he moved over to where I stood.
"You go on, Jack," he said. "That's all right, son. You do it now."
I looked at Dummy just before I laid out my cast. His face had gone rigid, and there was a thin line of drool on his chin.
"Come back stout on the sucker when he strikes," Dad said. "Sons of bitches got mouths hard as doorknobs."
I flipped off the drag lever and threw back my arm. I sent her out a good 40 feet. The water was boiling even before I had time to take up the slack.
"Hit him," Dad yelled. "Hit the son of a bitch. Hit him good."
I came back hard, twice. I had him all right. The rod bowed over and jerked back and forth. Dad kept yelling what to do.
"Let him go, let him go. Let him run. Give him more line. Now wind in, wind in. No, let him run. Woo-wee, will you look at that?"
The bass danced around the pond. Every time it came up out of the water, it shook its head so hard you could hear the plug rattle. And then he'd take off again. But by and by, I wore him out and had him in up close. He looked enormous. 6 or 7 pounds, maybe. He lay on his side, whipped, mouth open, gills working. My knees felt so weak I could hardly stand. But I held the rod up, the line tight. Dad waded out over his shoes. But when he reached for the fish, Dummy started sputtering, shaking his head, waving his arms.
"Now what the hell's the matter with you, Dummy? The boy's got hold of the biggest bass I ever seen, and he ain't going to throw him back, by God."
Dummy kept carrying on and gesturing toward the pond.
"I ain't about to let this boy's fish go. You hear me, Dummy? You got another think coming if you think I'm going to do that."
Dummy reached for my line. Meanwhile, the bass had gained some strength back. He turned himself over and started swimming again.
I yelled, and then I lost my head and slammed down the brake on the reel and started winding. The bass made a last furious run. That was that. The line broke. I almost fell over on my back. "Come on, Jack," Dad said, and I saw him grabbing up his pole. "Come on, the goddamn fool, before I knock the man down." That February, the river flooded. It had snowed pretty heavy the first weeks of December and turned real cold before Christmas. The ground froze. The snow stayed where it was. But toward the end of January, the Chinook wind struck. I woke up one morning to hear the house getting buffeted and the steady drizzle of water running off the roof. It blew for 5 days, and on the third day the river began to rise. "She's up to 15 feet, my father said one evening, looking over his newspaper, "which is 3 feet over what you need to flood. Old dummy is going to lose his darlings." I wanted to go down to the Moxie Bridge to see how high the river was running, but my dad wouldn't let me. He said a flood was nothing to see. 2 days later, the river crested, and after that, the water began to subside. Orrin Marshall and Danny Owens and I bicycled out to Dummies one morning a week after. We parked our bicycles and walked across the pasture that bordered Dummies' property. It was a wet, blustery day, the clouds dark and broken, moving fast across the sky. The ground was soppy wet, and we kept coming to puddles in the thick grass. Danny was just learning how to cuss, and he filled the air with the best he had every time he stepped in over his shoes. We could see the swollen river at the end of the pasture. The water was still high and out of its channel, surging around the trunks of trees and eating away at the edge of the land. Out toward the middle, the current moved heavy and swift, and now and then a bush floated by, or a tree with its branches sticking up. We came to Dummy's fence and found a cow wedged in up against the wire.